Welcome. You're listening to Writers' Voices. This is Cheryl Fusco-Johnson on KRUU 100.1 FM, and I have a fabulous guest who's going to be visiting Iowa soon. It's Polly Frost. Her humor has been published in The New Yorker, The Atlantic, The New York Times, and many other magazines. Her humorous essays have also been anthologized. Two of them were in The New Yorker's Best Of collections. With One Eye Open, a collection of her humorous essays in book form, that was a book that was published in 2010, and in reaction to that book, an Elle columnist and a life advisor, E. Jean Carroll, called Polly Frost the Edith Wharton of her generation. Polly also writes satirical erotic horror, and her book Deep Inside was published by Tor in 2007 and has been written about and reviewed over 50 times. The stories in this book are monologues for actors to read, and these stories were performed at Cornelia Street Cafe in New York City from 2003 to 2007. Polly Frost is married to Ray Sawhill, also a writer, and together they've co-ghostwritten a trashy, funny novel for a porn star, and they also co-wrote, directed, and produced Sex Scenes, a theater project which was a popular regular event at Cornelia Street Cafe. Ray and Polly also co-wrote the play The Last Artist in New York City, which was adapted from her short story of the same name, published in Narrative Magazine as a story of the week, and also in her humor collection with One Eye Open, which was incidentally a fabulous book, which I had the opportunity to read last week. That play, The Last Artist in New York City, was selected for Best American Short Plays in 2008 to 2009. So we have a very versatile writer with us today on Writers' Voices. Welcome, Polly.
Hi, thank you so much. I'm really excited about coming to Iowa. I have to say, you guys have a great community for writers. You know, I'm going to be doing two shows there, one in Des Moines at the Salisbury House on the 17th of May, and the other at the Engler Theater in Iowa City on the 19th. And I was just asked by Yael Khan, who lives in Iowa City and has a TV show there. He said, well, I'm going to be putting together an evening of humor-centric readings. Would you come on Friday night and do something? I was like, how fantastic is this? What a great welcome for a writer. Thank you, Iowa.
Well, we're really thrilled to have you coming to Iowa. Now, let me get clear when you're going to be here. Are you doing two performances, one in Iowa City and one in Des Moines, both on the same day? Is that what you just said?
I'm doing the one in Des Moines on the 17th, which is a Thursday, and that will be at Salisbury House, which I'm told is a fantastic, wonderful historical place, and that's at 7 o'clock on the 17th. And then on Saturday, the 19th, I will be in Iowa City, and I'll be doing it at the Engler Theater.
Which is also an historic theater, and we're really glad that you're going to be performing there.
I'm really excited about it. Yeah, I'm very excited about doing that. And I have never been to Iowa City, so I'm very, very pleased to be going there.
Oh, I think you'll like it. It's a real place for writers. You'll see that as soon as you start walking down the sidewalk and see the statues on the corners, and there's inscriptions of quotes from famous writers in the sidewalks. It's really cool.
That's so wonderful. I love that.
So one of the things I'm interested, because you're such a versatile writer, you've done so many different kinds of things, is how you got where you are today. So let's start.
You know, one of the things that I love that question. I just absolutely love it, because, you know, I have a lot of friends who are writers, and from the time they started out, they just said, I want to write historical novels or whatever they wanted to write, and that's what they wanted to do. For me, I always felt I had this karma as a writer. I don't want to get woo-woo here, but I mean, in just a general sense, I felt my karma as a writer was to explore different things, all of which are basically, I think, based in humor. But I wanted, from the time I was a kid, you know, I wrote plays, I ran my own little newspaper, I did lots of things. So for me, you know, a lot of writers will say to me, you're so versatile, and for me, it's just part of who I am. That's, I think every writer, don't you? I think every writer has their own feeling about who they are, and for me, it's being that very versatile person.
Well, that's a great way to be, because it makes you adaptable as well. As technology changes, you can change with it and do different kinds of writing.
And the thing is that's, again, I love that, what you just said, because when I started writing, it was in the mid-80s, and, of course, there have been just phenomenal changes since then. What I started out to do as a writer has, you know, that whole world has changed tremendously, and I felt about 10 years ago, I thought, well, either I can just say I don't want to deal with the changes, or I can embrace the changes and explore them. And that's what I decided to do.
One of the essays that I like best in your book, With One Eye Open, was about reblocking previously unblocked writers. I thought that was a really funny piece.
Thank you. Can I tell you a funny story about that?
Absolutely.
Because that piece, which I wrote in late 2008 and was published in The Atlantic in 2009, and that piece actually was rejected by, I sent it to The Atlantic because I thought they'd love it, and I love Corby Cummer, who was one of the first editors to ever publish me. So I sent it to him, but I didn't hear back from him, and so I sent it to a couple of other very good magazines, and they were like, well, I don't know if this is, I thought, well, I really believe that this piece is very resonant as a humor piece because it was about how much people are writing now as opposed to the way in which we used to think we were blocked. We had to unblock ourselves. And then Corby wrote me and he said, we love this piece at The Atlantic. We want to publish it. And it went viral. It very quickly. It got picked up by all sorts of places all over the world. And I even got interviewed by a reporter from Poets and Writers who thought that I had actually been this New Age guru that I say I was in the piece. So it was really interesting because at one point I had to say, no, I made that all. It's a satire. And that's what I love about humor. People will take humor in this very real way, and that's what you want. You want them to connect with it. So thank you. I'm glad you liked that piece.
Well, that sort of was a segue into one of my other questions for you, which was how has technology changed your career? But it sounds like it helped launch your career into a broader...
I love these questions you're asking because they're absolutely everything I've been thinking about. I started to feel that I wanted to do a lot of new media, so I wrote a web series and produced it for $8,000, and it's called The Fold, and I did it with a fantastic young director, lots of New York City actors and burlesque performers. People loved it. So I explored that whole thing of what is the web series. I explored, the whole thing of wanting to publish online because I felt that was really an important part of today, as well as publishing traditionally. And you know what it led me to? Is it led me to doing my one-person show because I ended up feeling as though all this virtual writing made me want to do live performances. It made me want to connect with audiences in a very direct, visceral way. Hmm. And that's where I am now.
That's really interesting. I had an editor on recently who talked about the way books are changing, and she sort of was calming. She had a calming perspective that we're still going to be reading books. We'll just be reading them in a lot of different formats. Uh-huh. What you're saying sort of underscores that in other media, uh-huh, that it's not that we're going to lose live performance. We're just going to have a lot of different ways to experience different sorts of artists. It sort of seems to be what you're saying.
I think actually now that people really want to have live performances. I mean, one of the things I discovered, I started doing my one-person show last June of 2011, and I became really surprised very quickly at how much people wanted to get away from their computers and go and talk to a writer, listen to a writer live. And I started thinking, wow, I think we are entering this whole new era where perhaps we are so much on the internet. So much, and I'm on the internet as much as anyone. I social network, I'm on Facebook, all that stuff. But I think we're craving this connection with writers because perhaps what's happened with all the blogging, with all the Twitters, is that we have made writing as traditional writing, perhaps that has become something so routine that we want to see the performance. I mean, maybe we're going back to the era of the oral tradition. Homer did pretty well with it, after all. So I figure it's not a bad tradition to go back to. And I believe that we're going to go into this era where you're going to see a lot more writers doing live performances.
Oh, that's interesting. So you've taken some acting classes, I understand, from reading about you online. And
yes.
Do you feel like that helped prepare you for this transition into doing live performances?
Taking acting classes very quickly when I came to New York City. My husband said to me, he said, I think you should take acting classes. My husband, Ray Sawhill, worked at Newsweek, and he covered books and arts at Newsweek magazine. And he said, I think it would be be terrific for your writing. It would be a whole other step. And so I went and took acting classes. And one of the first things I realized is I was not an actor. But it taught me, because actors are these amazing beings who can just live these characters. And I couldn't do that. I was always trying to write for the actor. So I started writing stuff and taking it into the actors to read in my class. And I very quickly realized that I wasn't an actor, but that I loved performing, and that you don't have to be an actor. You can be, I mean, Spalding Gray was an actor, the great monologuist, but what people wanted from Spalding Gray was to hear him talk about his experiences and to hear him on stage. And I think the same thing recently with Mike Daisy. Of course, that's a very interesting case, too. I don't know if is Mike Daisy come out to Iowa? He did his show, The Agony and Ecstasy of Steve Jobs, which was very controversial here.
I'm not really in the mainstream culture in a big way.
It's interesting to me because these people have taken the one-person show and taken it from acting to really talking to the audience. And that, to me, was really something I realized I wanted to do.
But do you still, like, how do you identify yourself in your own head? Like, do you feel like you're more of a writer or more of a performer?
My husband's always said that I'm 51% a performer and 49% a writer. You know, when you work with humor, and I've written erotica too, as you know, you're doing very audience-centric work. You're doing something where it's very existential, really. What you're doing is you're saying to the audience, I'm saying something that's funny. And so you are performing. Even if you're writing a humor piece and the humor piece is published, it's a performance because, you know, you're really appealing to the audience's sense of humor. So for me, it wasn't, I always defined myself very early on in my writing as much a performer as a writer.
Do you have any regrets about not being a horse trainer?
Oh, I do. And, you know, I really do. And it's one of the things that I want to do a show about, which is, you know, talking about that. I really think that, for me, I grew up riding horses, and I really love horses. I did see, however, that the people who trained them for many years had a lot of broken bones. And writing, at least, it's a lot safer.
Although you can do too much sitting, you know, end up with trouble if you're sitting too much.
Yeah, that's so true.
So I can kind of get where you're performing on the page, you know, if you're using the material from your own life.
Yes.
So it's sort of like a performance, it's just in print.
Yes, well, I think that's also a really interesting thing because for me, when I started to do this one-person show, it's about my own life. And one of the things that I had done for many years was write fiction and write these humor pieces that were fantasies. I wasn't doing memoir humor like David Sedaris, who's wonderful, of course, and people like that. I was really doing these very, you know, high-wire fictional humor pieces. And I really wanted to kind of get into things that were more personal. It's very interesting to portray yourself on stage. It's a very, very interesting thing that I have discovered.
So your book, With One Eye Open, is dedicated to your brother. And I understand you wrote that wrote those essays during a difficult time for your family. So
yes.
Would you talk a little bit about how humor can come from sadness or from hardship?
That's it. That's what humor is all about. I mean, writing humor during that period. My brother died in 2009 after a long and horrible and very heroic struggle with Parkinson's disease, which he got as a young man, and there was nothing you could say about it except that it sucked. But, you know, the thing was that in the aftermath of that, I really found that connecting with humor was one of the things that got me through it. And also, I realized I wanted to talk about that whole experience for me in my one-person show. And so, yes, yeah, very much so.
Will the show that you're doing at the Englert, is that the show you're talking about where you're...
Yes.
Oh, that'll be a very powerful show, I would think.
It's really interesting to me because The show is funny, but I, you know, after years of writing humor, I also realized I wanted to touch on things that didn't have to just be funny. It's not stand-up comedy. I don't do stand-up comedy. I have friends who do it. I love it, but that's not what I have ever done or want to do. And my show, How to Survive Your Adult Relationship with Your Family, which I'm doing in Iowa, that's really, it's funny. People laugh a lot. But they also cry during it, and then they laugh again. I mean, I think that's what's been really fascinating about doing the show is that, you know, people have these very varied emotions during it, and afterwards they come up and they talk to me about their own experiences, and I love that.
I could see where that would be very powerful, and it's, it seems like you're dealing with, you know, something that's so universal. Almost everyone has some sort of a family.
Mm-hmm.
And has good.
And we're told that, you know, it's your childhood that's the thing to get over and all that. But, you know, as I said at the beginning of my show, I had a happy childhood. I mean, you know, of course there was 7th and 8th grade that wasn't so terrific, but that wasn't my family's fault. But, you know, I had a happy childhood, but I think the real thing is that we're never prepared for the ways in which our families can change when we're adults. And it doesn't matter how much therapy you've had. There's all these things that get thrown at you, right, during your out relationship with your family that you never expected. All these curveballs. And I thought, nobody really talks about that. And that's something I wanted to talk about.
Well, that sounds like it's going to be a great show. I want to remind listeners, you're listening to KRUU 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Our guest today is Polly Frost, a humorist and a person who's very accomplished in many different kinds of writing. And I am your host, Cheryl Fusco Johnson, on Writer's Voices. And Polly, I wonder if you would share a little bit of your writing with our audience today.
I'd love to. You know, what I'd like to read is a piece that I wrote called Carbohydrates, which was written and published in the New Yorker magazine and selected for their best humor collection. And I'm going to read that now. Carbohydrates, 8:15 p.m. It's a balmy evening in February. It's the kind we've been having since global warming began. As usual, I'm standing around wondering when Jonathan is going to show up. He's already 15 minutes late. 8:17 p.m. Well, at least I've stopped wondering why I always get involved with the wrong man, why I constantly find myself in destructive relationships. I used to think it was my fault. And then I read this book, and suddenly I understood. He can try to deny it, but my father is an alcoholic, and I am an adult child of an alcoholic. Now, my father has never thought he was an alcoholic. Yet when I was growing up, he had to have a drink every night when he came home from work. And guess who fixed it for him? Oh, yes, me. He called it a genie after me. I've tried to help Dad face up to what he is, and I feel good about my efforts. Genie, he'll say. One drink, one little drink. One drink a night does not an alcoholic make. Dad, I tell him, you had to have it. Of course I had to, he'll say. If you knew the pressure of unit sales management. Well, Dad, you know what? I'm in retail dispersal, and you don't find me drinking. And then, my dad will say, I'd come home to, when are we going to get a new washing machine, and how are we going to pay for Jean's education and take that trip to Europe? Your mother had a million questions, but you were there to listen to your dad, and I never needed to go out and find a bartender, not when I had my genie. Dad, stop trying to implicate me in your behavior. I will not be your co-denier. And you knew, genie, that the olive has always been my favorite part. It's 8:21 p.m. Jonathan should not keep me waiting for dinner. He knows I'm hypoglycemic, even though he refuses to believe it. I mean, he thinks hypoglycemia was invented to annoy him. All those people who were really hypoglycemic, they gave it a bad name. You'd be in an art gallery with them, or you'd be trying on a pair of slacks, or you'd be talking about something that interested you, and out of the blue, they'd announce they were having an hypoglycemic attack. I mean, they absolutely had to eat that minute, or else they were going to faint. And it would all be your fault, of course, because they weren't hypoglycemic at all. Oh, no, they were manipulative, because me, I take responsibility for my own hypoglycemia. I always bring food with me. 8:25 p.m. You know, these really are pretty good cookies. I mean, macadamia nuts have a particularly stabilizing effect on my blood sugar, and so does guacamole, come to think of it. Too bad it's so hard to pack in a shoulder bag. The important thing is, I'm calmer. I'm convinced that stress is the number one factor in causing hypoglycemia. The stress from your job, the stress of being in a relationship, the stress of parents. You know what? Simply having parents is stressful. 8:30 p.m. The worst part of being an adult child of an alcoholic is that I always find myself in relationships with passive aggressives. It's so hard to tell if a man is passive aggressive. I mean, at first they seem perfect. They listen to you. They let you take charge. You want to discuss feminist issues? They don't get threatened. They smile. And then the other behavior begins. The endless waiting. You waiting for them. I was involved with this passive-aggressive Tim. I mean, I had to be the one to decide it was time for us to take a vacation and where we'd go and how we'd get there. He waited until we were at the airport to assert himself. Just as they were giving the final boarding call, he said he needed to buy a copy of GQ, and he wandered off. He never showed up on that flight. Me, I got on the plane anyway, and I had the worst hypoglycemic attack of my life. As soon as I landed in Oaxaca, I had to eat 5 orders of guacamole to get myself to the point where I could breathe regularly. I couldn't look at an avocado today if it weren't for how they stabilized me. Tim showed up at the hotel room 15 hours later with a big smile on his face. I threw all the chocolate flan I was eating right at him. And flan is a major source of simple carbohydrates. Tim wiped the chocolate off and proposed to me on the spot. You know, it doesn't take much to figure this one out. He'd driven me crazy and turned me into an exact replica of his mother, punishing him with my tears and my rage. Do I have to say anything more about men who want to marry their mothers? That's an excerpt from Carbohydrates. I won't read the whole thing because...
Kind of made me hungry for cookies and flan.
I know. Thank you. Thank you very much. Actually, that was written as a monologue for an actress I knew, and actors have done this monologue sometimes without informing me that they were doing it. I'd find out that they were doing it.
So how has that affected your career, being around a lot of performers?
Oh, I love it. I just love performers. You know, I know a lot of people make fun of actors, but to me, they are so giving. You know, you write the stuff, and you write a character, and, you know, I can read this piece, but when you hear a really good actress doing it, it just is amazing. You think, wow, they get that character, and they embody that character that I wrote. Have you ever written for actors or worked with them?
No, I have not.
Really? It's a fascinating process. I recommend it for any writer because I love collaborating, first of all. I love writing alone, but I also love collaborating. It's fascinating to work with actors.
And you and your husband do a lot of collaborating, it sounds like.
We do, and I'm really lucky because we collaborate very well together, and it's a wonderful thing. He's very good at structure, and I'm very good at getting into characters, so we never really compete with each other.
Huh. Now, you met in college, is that right?
Oh, no. We met, actually, through a woman who was the film critic at The New Yorker, Pauline Kael. She was the very famous, very infamous film critic at The New Yorker from, I think, the mid to late 60s through 1992 when she retired. There's just recently been a biography written about her by Brian Kellogg that's gotten lots of press and is really terrific. And she thought that my husband and I would really get along well, so she match-made for us, and she said it was one of her proudest accomplishments.
What an incredible...
She was right about that.
That's just an incredible story.
Thank you. It was quite wonderful.
So I'm glad you brought her up, because I read a very interesting interview that you and your husband together did of her, mm-hmm. and she made some comments that I thought were particularly interesting, and I was going to... mention these comments and see if you could react to them.
Thank you.
So about her own writing during this interview that you did with her, uh-huh. She said, I was just trying to reach the public as directly as possible. It's mainly a kind of courage you need in order to write the way you think instead of writing the way you've been taught.
Oh, yes.
So what do you think of that?
Oh, I think that was one of the most amazing things that Pauline did, and it was one of the things I really learned from her. I think what was fascinating about Pauline Kael was that her audience had this very, very intense relationship with her because she wrote very directly, because, you know, she was a Californian, like I am, and she did not believe in the proprieties of the East Coast in terms of writing, and she famously fought quite a bit with William Shawn, who was the editor of The New Yorker, and that's all in the biography about her, and it's quite wonderful stuff. But what I learned from Pauline is that if you communicate very directly with people, it's this wonderful thing that you give your audience, and they feel like they have this conversation with you. And I think that's a wonderful thing for a writer to do.
Did you take writing classes in college or workshopped?
No, I didn't. I wanted to do anything but write when I was in college. I wanted to be a music composer. I studied music, and people just kept saying to me, you should write. And finally, I took a writing workshop in Los Angeles in my late 20s. From a man who is now the bookworm on radio, Michael Silverblatt. And I thought I was going to write these very serious short stories, and I brought one into the class, and it was my John Hawkes, you know, kind of experimental, crossed with Ann Beatty kind of, you know, all this stuff. And as I read it to the class, they all started laughing, and it was so mortifying to me. And afterwards, Michael said to me, you know, you have no talent for literary fiction, but you're funny, and you should go with that. And I thought about it, and at first I felt really demoralized, but then I realized, you know, you have to go with what you are as a writer and who you are as a creative person, and so I thought he was right.
Well, it sounds like it might have been a wounding experience at the time, but you've gone pretty far with that.
You know, I think it was really, really good for me because it shook off all these feelings I had. I think a lot of the time, you know, I think for a lot of us who are creative people, it's such a funny thing to do in so many ways. I mean, it's such a fantastic thing to be creative. But the rest of the world can look at you and say, well, you're not really a serious grown-up person. You're just, you know, playing around with your words and doing this. And you want to say, I really am serious. And I went through that for a long time, thinking, well, I really am a serious person, and I think what I realized is that being playful is serious. It's about the most serious thing that you can do is to be very playful, don't you think?
I absolutely agree with you, and I think through humor, you can come to accept different parts of yourself, you know, come to be aware of who you are and who other people are,
uh-huh.
And it gives you, like, sort of the emotional distance if you use humor to say real truths.
Oh, I love that, what you just said. That's absolutely true. I completely agree with you.
I have another one of these quotes from Pauline Kael that I want to ask you about. And she says, self-improvement and art don't really belong together. If art opens your eyes and your senses, that's something else. So what do you think about that?
I think, well, Pauline really couldn't stand edifying works. She had no time for works of art that, you know, were very stuffy, and she felt that people should go with their instincts and with pleasure. She was very, very much into pleasure, and I think that that's a very profound thing, because I think sometimes we put down those things that give us very direct pleasure, and we think maybe they're not as profound in terms of art as those works of art that kind of give us pain and that we have a hard time slogging through. So I think that was quite extraordinary for Pauline to say that, don't you?
I do, because I think things that are written to be didactic are so off-putting that they just don't get their messages across at all. I think you have to be more subtle if you're trying to convey your point of view to other people.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that we're often taught that the works of art that are very difficult are often the ones that are the most profound. Now, I happen to love Bach's music, J.S. Bach. You know, I love the Art of the Fugue. I love the Well-Tempered Clavier. And, you know, that's very complex contrapuntal music. And I love late Beethoven's string quartets. But there's also something really wonderful about a pop tune that you just can't get out of your head. And to say that you don't love that or that that isn't a deep experience for you, I think Pauline was right about that.
One of the things that I found interesting is that you said that laughing together was one of the best things that you did as a family. And so do you think that the propensity to be able to write humor is inborn? Do you think it's cultivated by having a family that's funny? Where do you think that talent for writing humor comes from?
Well, I think, you know, it's really interesting because, you know, after the Christopher, I don't know if you read the Christopher Hitchens piece about why women can't be funny and then in Vanity Fair, but I often get asked about that piece because he said that, you know, women can't be funny, and of course, you know, everybody jumped on him. But I kind of feel that he was raising something very, very interesting, which was the ways in which humor is seen as you're growing up. It is true that if you're a funny young girl and you're a very satirical young girl, you can kind of terrify a lot of other people. I was very lucky because within my family, a sense of humor was very valued. And it was seen as something very positive. Both of my parents had very good senses of humor when I was growing up, especially about themselves, and that was great. But I think I often find that people who grow up in a family where humor is seen as something, you know, that's impolite or that they really shouldn't do, it becomes very difficult for them to, they want to be funny, but, you know, they have to work towards that. Hmm. And I also do think that you're born funny or not funny. I do think humor is one of those things that's very hard to teach.
Hmm. So when you say that a family, like, gravitates towards humor, how would that manifest itself? So, like, in your family, did you guys, like, watch funny movies or tell jokes at dinner?
I think it was the sense that, you know, life is essentially tragic and that the tragic things of life are... can only be processed and dealt with through humor. And both of my parents are still alive. My biological father just turned 90, and my mom is 86. So it's obviously is good for you in terms of that. I don't know. Was your family funny? It's always interesting to me to find out about it. Was your family, did they
you
have
know,
a wonderful sense of humor?
I've been thinking about that since reading your book. I want to remind listeners that our guest today is Polly Frost, and the book that we're discussing is With One Eye Open, and she's also going to be performing here in Iowa around May. You'll have to tell us in a minute, but in response to your question, I had to think about it. You know, I had to think, well, was my family funny? And then I remembered that we would sit around the table and my mother would tell us the hysterical stories about, you know, things that she would do wrong. Like she was an air raid warden during World War II, and she's, you know, supposed to keep her little neighborhood dark. And threw my father's college jacket over the lamp in her house and it caught on fire. You know, it's like she was always telling us stories like that. And
that's wonderful.
It was fun. And when my son was, you know, with us visiting them, that my husband and my son and my mom and dad would sit around, and for hours after we ate, we'd just be sitting around the dirty dishes and she'd be repeating these same stories. So there's like, they're almost like chapters in a book, the different stories about, you know, when she was a manager of an apartment building during the war and when she was, you know, trying to do the air raid warden thing. So I never thought about it in terms of humor, but that's, I guess, what that was, you know, sitting around and telling self-effacing humor.
I think that's wonderful. I mean, I don't think you have to come from a family where people are stand-up comedians in your family. In fact, I think that would be very difficult because all the stand-up comedians I've known are really competitive. They're so competitive. And stand-up comedy is very, very aggressive. I think that having a family where that sense of the absurd and that sense of how life plays itself out in these ways is just, it's very important. And then we all have those relatives, which is something I go into my show, who have no sense of humor, and they're the funniest ones of all. They're the ones who really teach you what humor is, because people who take themselves so seriously are sometimes just a gift to a humorist, because, you know, that's the other thing about writing humor. You have to take it very seriously. If you say, this is funny, it's not going to be funny for people, but the people who take themselves very seriously and are completely absurd, those are your gift, because they're always the ones who are really funny.
Yeah, I did read an interview, someone interviewed you online, and you discussed how your husband told you about that when you had to make calls, letting people know that your brother had passed. Mm-hmm. And you came across this person who was this very insensitive.
Oh, yes.
Just very insensitive. And yet, you know, your husband said, well, that person's a gift. And it seemed like that might have sparked you to start writing these essays that ended up as your book with One Eye Open.
It's really true. I mean, that was a particular experience because, as we all know, when somebody dies, you need to make these phone calls. And I had called this person that I knew, and, you know, I said, you know, my brother died. And she said, oh, I was just at my masseuse, and my masseuse had all these problems. And I was like, did you hear what I just said? I said, my brother died. And she was like, well, you know, people die all the time. And I was like, I don't know if I can have this conversation. And, you know, afterwards my husband was like, you should call her back and keep having this conversation because it's so hilarious. And, you know, it was interesting because that conversation, when I wrote it down, my mom and I just started laughing so hard about it because I think there is this thing for some people when somebody dies, they can't deal with it at all. And all these other people who were so wonderful were fantastic, and they were great. But this woman really almost broke me up so much because she was just so completely insensitive.
Well,
she was a gift to me.
The other bizarre thing was it sounded like she kept sending you emails that were even worse, you know, so it was
so
crazy-making. So
it was terrible. I think the poor woman just kept, you know, she had no idea. And then she wanted to come over and perform some ritual with us that was going to make us all feel better. And by that point, I said, I really think this is a very bad idea because, you know, she wanted to do some plant in the garden. And I just thought it kept going and going. And my mom and I just started getting more and more hysterical over it. And I think, finally, I almost felt like calling up and saying, thank you very much. You know, you actually made me laugh at a time which was so difficult for me.
It's a very strange response. But your response to it is like, I guess that key thing of tragedy, you have to kind of figure out how you're going to go on.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, one of the ways to go on.
You really do. And I think that's the thing that's wonderful. When you find somebody in your life who shares your sense of humor, you can go through periods of your life that can be very, very difficult, and you can find that sense of humor. I mean, I think that's a really important thing, and I think that's why people love those writers who make them laugh or make them feel very understood, don't you? I think that's what we love.
Yeah, and I guess there really is a connection. Often you feel like, you know, the public feels like they have a connection with famous people,
mm-hmm.
but maybe there really is a connection if you get their humor and you laugh at what they're saying and stuff
mm-hmm.
like that. One of the things that you just said touched off the last of my Pauline Kael quotes that I wanted to get your impression of. And this was one where she said, I've generally become friends with people because we laugh at the same thing and we're laughing at ourselves.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, well, that's kind of interesting to see, you know, if people have the same sort of sense of humor that you do. Do you find that
Pauline had a wonderful sense of humor, and she had this wonderful way about her of, she's very egalitarian. She just really liked the people that she liked, and she would be the same to a famous person or a famous director that she met, as I watched her be to a wait person at a restaurant who said, Ms. Kael, I just read your review, and I have to tell you, I disagree with you. I mean, she was completely egalitarian that way, but what she really loved most, I think, were the people who made her laugh and the people who, you know, really had that response with her, yes.
So that must be what she saw in both you and your husband that kind of made her decide, oh, this would make a nice couple.
I think so, actually. You know, Pauline and I never agreed about movies very much. I mean, that's one of the really amazing things about our friendship is that she was famously seen as somebody who would cut you out of her life if you didn't agree about movies with her, but in fact, she and I really disagreed all the time, and we got along very, very well. I never found that about her. I found her to be an extremely open-minded, very opinionated, but very open-minded person.
And it sounds like someone who left a real strong legacy on the art of critiquing culture.
She did. I think that, you know, what Pauline was very lucky because she was writing at a time when movies were very exciting, and she was writing at a time when pop culture was something you could write about, and she was writing at a time when, you know, you could get paid as a critic to do this. And so it all came together. But on top of that, Pauline was quite extraordinary. And she created this whole legacy that really transcends whether you've even seen the movie she's writing about. It's just a wonderful way of looking at art.
You touched on something there that I want to follow up on, and that is like monetizing writing. So we're seeing the publishing industry going through some tumultuous times. You know, things are changing. But do you think that writers are going to be able to make a living in the world as it's evolving into different forms of technology?
Oh, I think that's just so difficult for writers, and I think we're seeing all sorts of ramifications of it. I think that definitely the world into which I started writing, the world of glossy magazines that published intelligent writing and paid you well for it, that's definitely gone. On the other hand, there's a whole world that's opened up so that writers can really write now what they really want in blogs, and so that's good too. But the monetization thing is definitely a real issue for writers, and it's one of the things that I like about performing, because people want to get out of the house and come to a performance. It's much harder, I think, today for writers to say, buy my ebook. What does an ebook mean sometimes to someone if they're already online? They're like, why should I pay for that ebook? You know, it's an ebook. And I think that's why I think you're going to see a lot more writers doing live performances. Now, that's not why, I mean, I love doing the live performances, but I have also found that it's a much more, it's a much better way for me as a writer to make money.
Mm-hmm. So let's remind listeners that you are Polly Frost, you're a humorist, you're accomplished in many different kinds of writing, and you're going to be visiting Iowa, and maybe you could tell us where those performances are going to be.
Absolutely. I'm going to be performing at the wonderful historic venue, which is Salisbury House in Des Moines, on Thursday, May 17th at 7 p.m. Salisbury House has a website, salisburyhouse.org, and tickets can be bought there. I'm also going to be performing on Saturday, May 19th at the Englert Theater in Iowa City. And again, that's a fantastic venue. And again, tickets are available off the website, which is very easy to find, the Englert Theater.
And I think that people who are interested in humor would really enjoy this performance, so you may want to turn out for that. And if people wanted to follow you on social media, how would they do that?
I'm on Facebook. You know, I'm on Facebook, and I'm not so much on Twitter. People can find my website, polyfrost.com. I love social media, and I am often asked, you know, how I do it, because people say that I do social media well. But, you know, the truth of the matter is that I love social media, but I really feel that social media is kind of a tangle, don't you? It's kind of an interesting tangle for writers. I feel like I love to meet people there, but I even more love to meet them at my performances, because then I see the actual person, and that's fantastic for me.
I would think that as a creative person, you might get a little bit more inspiration from doing your performances and meeting people than from sitting at your computer.
I do. I do get a lot more. And again, you know, I'm on Facebook a lot, so I don't want to sit here and pretend like I'm not on Facebook, because I am, and I have nearly 5,000 quote-unquote friends on Facebook, and many of whom are fascinating people I've met through Facebook, and I'm very grateful for that. But I find that it's so interesting to me when people come up to me after one of my live performances and they start talking about things, and it's just amazing, because I see that person. Also, when you are in front of a live audience, it's immediate, the feedback that you get from the audience, and that's really fantastic, and it changes night after night, and I love that.
So what accounts for the change? Do you think it's just the culture of the city that you're in at the time?
I think it's all sorts of things. I think that's what's really fascinating about live performance. You know, one of the things people, I mean, I think that each venue has its own particular vibe. I think the audience comes to it with particular expectations. And one of the things I have people say to me is, they say, don't you want to record your performance? And I'm like, I don't think so. I really like the impermanence of what I'm doing. Now, I say that as somebody who wrote and published for 25 years, and now all of a sudden I'm much more fascinated by the fact that this is an impermanent art form that I'm doing. It changes from night to night. I love that.
Hmm.
That for me is it evaporates as soon as I've done it. I'm very directly connecting with the people in the audience at that moment. I'm really loving this because I've gotten more into thinking about the impermanent arts and feeling as though that's something that I really am drawn to much more than making monuments of my art.
I wonder if you would feel the same way if you hadn't been doing print media for so long, if you didn't already have like a body of work that was permanent.
I think that's really, really smart, and I think you're right about that. I think I wouldn't feel the same way, but having that, and I love what I have published, but having that, I am now really fascinated by the fact that each performance is just, sometimes you're completely in sync with the audience. Sometimes there's one person who just, you know, is sitting there and you think, you know, is that person even getting it? And then afterwards that person may come up to you and say, I really love this. And so I love all those variables and those things that can't be fixed.
Yeah, things that you don't.
Yeah.
I would do want to remind listeners, you're listening to Writers' Voices. This is Cheryl Fusco Johnson. We're on KRUU 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. And our guest today is Polly Frost, author of With One Eye Open. And she's slated to come and visit Iowa to do a show called How to Survive Your Adult Relationships with Your Family. Would you like to share a last bit of your writing with us? We don't have too much time left, but we could hear another short excerpt if you have one.
Oh, I'd love to. This, again, is a piece about carbohydrates, so you can see there's a theme
in
my work, which was published just a year ago in the Barnes & Noble Review, and the same editor I worked with at The New Yorker, Dan Menaker, who was the head of Random House for a while, he started up this wonderful magazine, humor magazine, that was on the Barnes & Noble Nook for about a year. And he published this piece of mine as he published the first one that I read. So this is a very short piece called New Carbs. Along with everyone else, you've probably been reading a lot about carbs recently. Good carbs with their fiber and vitamins, and bad carbs, which we need to start avoiding. And I don't know about you, but, you know, when I read this report, something seems amiss. I'm someone who has spent decades devotedly exploring the world of carbs, and I know in my bones there is far more to the carb picture than scientists have puzzled out. So recently, I decided to do my own close observational study and note down my findings about different kinds of carbs that aren't covered by the scientists, and here they are. Foreign carbs. How is it that a foreign name can add innumerable benefits to any dish? For example, on Tuesday, I had the chance to compare two identical food items. The first was a donut at 7-Eleven, and the second was a beignet I purchased not long after across the street at Patisserie Antoine. The donut produced a heedless urge in me to wolf it down, followed by an avalanche of remorse. The experience with the beignet could not have been more different, although I suspect that Antoine buys his beignets from the same supplier as 7-Eleven. But he pronounced the word beignet, and he placed the pastry on the tiny table I was seated at, and I found myself purring. Instead of zooming off, I lingered, eating in a civilized manner and engaging in a most delightful flirtation with Antoine, despite the fact that I had flunked high school French. I spent the rest of the day smiling. Regrets? Rien. Especially after having given my phone number to Antoine. My next category is silly carbs. This is something that's a carbohydrate-related mystery. Why do we, one, have a sense of well-being when we nibble candy that's molded like a high-heeled shoe, or two, feel rapturously giddy when we drink a cocktail that's a preposterous color? Or three, forget about our waistlines when pasta shows up on our plates in adorable curlicue shapes? I mused about these questions as I waited for Antoine the next evening at a waterside bar. I played with my blue Hawaii's little parasol and I asked myself, why is it that scientists are so damned obsessed by the intricate chains of oligosaccharides that they find in complex carbs? Feeling woozy inspiration, I challenged the hunky, sunburned stranger next to me a bit. Whichever one of us said, oligosaccharide slower would buy this next round of Blue Hawaiis. He eyed me up and down and then agreed, and soon everyone in the place was shouting oligosaccharide and demanding I dance on top of the bar. How could I refuse? Never before, Harrod, I cared less about how my behavior appeared to others. And my conclusion? Silly carbs often lead to excellent exercise sessions. Antoine did not show up, however. Frenchmen, overpriced carbs, my last category. I nursed a hangover the next day, and then my intercom buzzer sounded. It was Antoine, pleading in French. I buzzed him up, and in response to his knock, opened the door. There he stood, holding out an exquisitely wrapped box. Chocolates? I snapped at him. I'm not that easy, Antoine. But do you know how adorable you are when you are angry? He murmured. Don't try that suave stuff on me, I said. But I grabbed a box of sweets from him anyway, and as I did, his eyes caught a label the store hadn't removed from the box. He swore as he reached over and tore it off. But I'd caught a glimpse of how much he'd spent. And that's when I experienced the miraculous effect of overpriced carbs. Indeed, even before I tasted a single one of the chocolates, I felt overwhelmed with forgiveness. Antoine popped a chocolate truffle in my mouth, and it was a fitting ending to my carbohydrate research. I was pleased with my contributions to science. For a moment, I did wonder if Antoine had planted a phony price tag on the box, but even if he had, wasn't that sweet in its own way?
I don't know. These carbs, you're going to make me run out and get chocolate and donuts, too.
I do love carbs.
That was fun. Thank you for sharing that. There's a topic that I haven't touched on yet, and I was kind of curious. I saw something online about your feelings about current YA fiction.
Oh.
And I was surprised that you had exposure to current YA fiction.
I do. You know, I think the interesting thing is that I had written one of the short pieces in my book with When I Open is called That Final Paper You Want From Me, which was published in Narrative. I had some agents talk to me and say, well, it's a short story, but it'd make great YA fiction. And, you know, what they really meant by that was I was going to take this short story, which was a satirical short story about a young woman, and turn it into this kind of completely other thing, which was YA fiction. And I kind of started thinking about YA fiction and thinking, you know, I loved YA fiction when I was growing up because it wasn't done as YA fiction. It wasn't done with this idea that you're going to better teens. It was just great fiction that just grabbed you as a teenager. Now, I'm not saying that there isn't YA fiction right now that isn't like that, but that whole attitude that the YA fiction has to be very politically correct and has to somehow give you these characters that change in good ways. I don't know. That drives me crazy. Thank you. Huh. I didn't know anybody saw that comment of mine about YA fiction.
And just so readers or listeners know, so we're talking about young adult fiction, which kind of runs a gamut. I mean, it can be The Catcher in the Rye. It can be...
Yes, which is wonderful, yeah.
Fear Street books. I mean, it can be very serious literature, and right now it seems to be sort of... I don't know. How would you describe where we are today?
Publishing industry is, unfortunately, it's not at the forefront of culture. It's lagging behind, and I think that's too bad, because when I was growing up, books were the cutting edge of culture. So when we talk about YA fiction of the past, like Catcher in the Rye, well, that was really at the forefront of what was going on in the terms of how people saw things right then. I think right now that there's this feeling with the book industry of being very cautious and not wanting to ruffle feathers, and I think that's too bad, because I think that's not what books are about. I think what books are about is you pick up this book and it changes your life, and in very surprising ways.
Well, there probably are still those books for people. We may not know like how someone is reacting to certain books.
Oh, I agree with you. I'm making a generalization, but I agree with you. I think there are definitely those books, yes. But I think that if Jack Kerouac was publishing On the Road today, he might very well be told, well, you know, might be, you know, maybe he did it as a YA novel and then the characters learn something at the end of it. You know, I mean, there is a cautiousness in the book industry right now that is too bad. Now, that's not to say that they don't publish some wonderful books. They do. and some books that change people's lives. They do. But it's just to say that I think there's an overriding sense of cautiousness.
Okay, I have one more topic I want to try to cover with you before our time elapses here, and that's the role of mentors. And you mentioned Dan, I can't remember how you pronounce his last name.
Vinegar?
Right. So what role did he have in your life, or someone like Pauline Kael? And if a person wants to find a mentor, like how do you find a mentor if you're a young writer?
I love that, because, you know, the title of my next show that I'm going to be doing for the first time in the fall is called Bad Role Models and What I've Learned from Them. So it's all about the fact that the best mentors I ever had were the worst role models in my life. I have been very lucky to have had some fantastic people like Dan Menaker and Pauline, who taught me a great deal about writing. But, you know, what I'm going to be going into in my next show is the fact that, in surprising ways, the people who were probably the worst role models taught me the most about being creative and about being an artist. And so I'm really looking forward to writing that show.
Could you concisely and briefly give us, maybe not a name, but an example of a bad role model that had a positive influence on your writing?
Oh, absolutely. You know, getting back to the whole thing of bad role models, one of the people when I was growing up who was very instrumental in getting me to read and to read about things was somebody who was considered a tremendous oddball in the community where I was growing up. And in fact, he wasn't really a success. The older I get, the more I realize how much he gave me and how much support he gave me as a writer exploring my own voice. And I remember my parents saying, he's not a good role model for you. And, you know, the more I look back on it, he sadly died about 12 years ago. He was a lot older than I was. The more I look back on it, I think, but he really cared about the arts, and he really believed in me as a writer. And that was really fantastic. I mean, all the other things about him probably weren't.
Oh, absolutely. Somebody having confidence in you, I think, you know, that would count for a lot as you move
forward. It did help for a lot. And I think also, though, there are those other people who, you know, you just think, wow, they did these things in such crazy ways, I could never do that. And they aren't maybe good role models. But to me, I think we're obsessed with that good role model mentor thing. And so I'm really looking forward to exploring those people in my life who've taught me so much, you know, by being bad role models.
Well, what a fun career you have.
Thank you. Thank you so much. This has been such a pleasure to talk to you.
Oh, I've enjoyed talking to you, too. And I want to remind listeners, this is KRUU 100.1 FM. You've been listening to Writers' Voices. I'm Cheryl Fusco Johnson. Our guest today was Polly Frost, and she's going to be coming to Iowa, and you can find out about her appearances in Iowa if you visit her website. And thank you for being with us today.
Thank you so much. I'm really looking forward to coming to Iowa.
Writers' Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, Cheryl Fusco Johnson, and Corey Hickenbottom. Archives are available at KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com. Writers' Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.